Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
By you to determine whether John Hopkins All Children's Hospital breached one of the legal duties or standards of care that I explained to you in these instructions. Likewise, the fact that an employee may have complied with these requirements does not mean that Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital cannot be found to have breached one of the legal duties or standards of care that I have explained to you in these instructions. Again, the fact is only evidence that may be considered by you to determine whether Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital did not breach one of the legal duties or standards of care that I have explained to you in these instructions.
Why can't we just stick to the standard jury instruction in the form?
To the best of my knowledge, there's no standard jury instruction on internal policies or on the Bill of Rights. In reading this, I think that's the last sentence there is probably something that can be omitted.
Don't we have a separate section? Pardon me if I'm wrong on this and you incorporated it, but isn't there an entire separate instruction about a parent agency? Why
yes.
do you have to put it in every single time?
And because this is not a parent agency.
Can I talk?
One at a time, please.
Yeah.
My problem with this, Judge, is the reasserting of certain parts of other instructions continuously into the causes of action. And if the jury hears it once there and once when the court reads the actual instruction, that it's emphasizing one instruction over the other instructions. And I don't think that's appropriate and proper. To me, if once we have a parent agency in there, that's where it should stay, and we shouldn't try to divert the jury and confuse them in this count by doing that, by inserting now another, and I don't think it's even the same one, as the parent agency.
Well, they're different issues.
The Bill of Rights issue, I'm not sure why we're talking about a parent agency. I mean, this to me is like evidence of negligence, like a violation of a statute or a rule, an ordinance, something like that.
Correct.
I think what he's looking for is negligence.
I am generally fine with the concept of that type of instruction. What I really need to see is where it physically goes and in the flow of everything. So, right. Like with what we talked about a few minutes ago, why don't we include it where you think it needs to go, and then we can nitpick as to where we move it if we need to move it. But
and I can do that, and I'm pretty flexible on that. I was putting it there because I thought that was the first claim that involved all these references to the parent, the patient's rights and responsibilities division.
But I do think it is important, given the emphasis of the patients and families' rights that we've heard about, that we need to have it. I'm not sure it is a count specific.
I only want it once.
So you propose where it is, and then Mr. Elegant and Mr. Anderson might disagree, but let's at least put it in where you think it's going to go, but we're going to have it someplace.
And immediately preceding the apparent agency is not as part of the apparent agency I was suggesting two more instructions there that I filed on October 26th in a motion for three matters for final instruction. That's DIN 3556.
Well, I'm not sure where on the jury instructions I should be looking right now.
They're not. I had not slid them into this yet. Again, if you want me to, I can do all of that. But we hadn't. Neither Tom nor I had slid some of the special instructions into this when we finished on Friday.
Okay. So what is the language you want me to look at? Where do I find it?
It's in DIN 3556, and it's probably page 2. Formatting is a little confusing because it didn't indent. But at the bottom of that page, it's not a short instruction, but it states basically the description of who Sally Smith is and what she does for the Child Protective Team. Now, and she was allowed to testify about this, and as long as there's no fight about whether she was telling the truth, maybe this is unnecessary in light of the testimony the other day. But it explains that the Department of Health is required to provide the services of a multidisciplinary child protective team in each of the service circuits of the Department of Children and Families, and that the team must be led by a medical director who is a doctor that's board certified in pediatrics and has additional training in child abuse.
Let me short circuit this, because I'm generally okay with the concept. And in most parts, I think you track the statute. I point out this telephone consultation services because the evidence was that first telephone call, Dr. Smith was not wearing her hat as medical director. So I don't want to give the impression by a instruction that she was acting as a medical director at that time.
All right. And if that part is confusing, I can take out the statutory discussion of the consultation part of this. It's a short part of this. I have to put a list, but who's going to know the details?
What I would suggest is you dump in the language where you think that concept is an issue, the telephone, and then the implication of diagnosis and treatment.
All right, I can do that.
Is you know, also right. Somewhat concerning. So put it in, and then we can fight over the specific verbiage, but it would help me out if I can see it as a functional whole.
Functional thing. And you're probably going to tell me the same thing on the next one, which is we had orders prepared on ketamine and whether they could use it or whether the judge was prohibiting its use that we prepared but were not read to the jury. And I wanted to put those in there as well. So
an instruction on ketamine?
On the fact that what the court orders did as to whether the father could or could not have her use ketamine. She could not use ketamine so long as she was in the dependency proceeding, but she could use it as soon as it was over, basically.
Do we give a date, Chris?
That is an issue of fact as to their knowledge at the time, and I will have to bring in an additional witness.
Then they can bring in additional witnesses.
Well, they had a lawyer at the time.
That's who I would bring in.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, I guess. They had you for a long time, too. So.
Not for this stuff.
Judge, part of the January order, if I'm remembering right, is the one that says they cannot use it.
That's correct.
And then the April order just says she's released to her father. Right. And the proceeding, well, actually, the January order said that. The April order says, okay, this proceeding is done. But it doesn't say, you know, have at it with ketamine.
Yes, it does.
Here is the concept. I do not like the phraseology Mr. Alton Byrne used after that order. Mr. Kowalski was not prohibited by law from authorizing a doctor to administer ketamine. I think it needs to be more in the along the lines of, at that time, all orders terminated or ceased or whatever.
Okay. I can do that. And then I'll slide it into that location so everybody can look at that. And then I believe we are okay on apparent agency at this point with what is in here. The preliminary issue here, I believe we have all worked out at this point.
What page are we on?
Yeah.
This is pages 15 and 16.
Okay. Not in the jury instructions in 10-35-86.
No, in the instructions.
He's back on the jury instructions.
I'm sorry, back in the instructions. This was something we had worked out before.
Agency?
What?
It's the preliminary issue.
I'm sorry, I'm just not finding agency in the document, that's all.
Top of page 16. Well, actually, bottom of page 15, I'm sorry. In addition to.
It says, in addition to negligence of doctors who are its agents or employees, John Hopkins All Children's Hospital can become legally responsible for the medical negligence of a doctor who is not an employee or an agent of the hospital when the doctor is what the law describes as an apparent agent of the hospital. Doctors are not employees or agents of the hospital merely because they have staff privileges at the hospital. They can, however, be treated as apparent agents of the hospital if the proof establishes that they fall within this category. And then the rest of this is very, very close to the standard instruction throughout. I don't think Mr. Elegant and I had problems with the next two paragraphs. We worked a long time to get the one I just read to you.
Well, if you and Mr. Elegant worked it out, I don't think we need to spend more time on it.
I don't know what we were trying to do, and hopefully it's been accomplished, is to make it clear that while having privileges doesn't mean you're having staff privileges doesn't mean you're an apparent agent, on the other hand, having staff privileges doesn't mean you're not an apparent agent, that it's sort of a neutral.
What's the next?
The next issue on that is that they have a request on page 19 for an aggravation or activation of disease instruction.
Are we in?
And this is still in medical negligence.
Medical negligence.
And the thing that I assume they are saying that is the pre-existing condition that we activated or aggravated is CRPS. And the only evidence they presented on this was the pure opinion evidence that came from Dr. Chopra and Dr. Kirkpatrick, I believe. I don't believe there was another. And they opine that it was their opinion that because we interrupted ketamine for this 100 days, that down the road that she would have much worse CRPS at some point in time, that things would happen more often and the like, etc. The problem is that we're no longer a pure opinion state. So they can say all of that and put it into evidence, but there still has to be some scientific basis for a pure opinion. And here we have a situation where ketamine has been used as a controversial item for only a short amount of time for these things. No one was describing that they had had a similar child with this. No one was saying, I've had 40 patients that were interrupted this way and half of them ended up with an aggravation of it. This is just speculation about something that might happen in the future based on pure opinion of those doctors and nothing else. And that's not sufficient evidence to go to a jury on aggravation.
But isn't the question of pure opinion something that is something that we addressed prior to?
But
the evidence is now in.
You can do that, right, to keep the evidence out. But, and I can't raise this after the jury's verdict, but because of the way it was put in, I can still take the position that, yes, it's come in, but it is not competent evidence to establish an aggravation so that it shouldn't go to a jury.
Maya Kowalski testified how bad she felt when she got out of there.
Yes.
Mr. Elligott, anything further you'd like to add?
Your Honor, I have to defer to the trial counsel. I understand there was, you know, that there are her treating doctors, and these are treaters. These aren't some experts being brought in. These are treaters who said this made it worse.
Who else could testify to it? Maya.
With respect to Maya Kowalski, I intend on giving an aggravation or activation of disease or defect instruction.
Okay.
I think there's evidence in the record to support that instruction. What's next?
On, we can move on, I believe, to negligent infliction of emotional distress. And on this one, I mean, we have some very basic problems. If you look at this, begins on page 19 and then flows on to page 20. And their instruction is that Maya Kowalski claims that John Hopkins was negligent in the manner in which it interacted with Jack and Beata Kowalski, which inflicted emotional distress on Maya Kowalski. That's nothing close to a claim under Zell or Champion. They have not alleged, I've been through this repeatedly, that there's going to be no finding that John Hopkins committed a negligent act against Jack or Beata. And the predicate count that either needs to have been resolved in an earlier lawsuit or in this lawsuit is that there was some impact causing injury to Jack or Beata that was a fairly traumatic event that she experienced in one fashion or another. You have actually eliminated Jack's negligent infliction of emotional distress claim, which was the only claim of negligence as to him, and Beata has none as well. And if you look at the allegations that she made in the complaint, she's not complaining that this was because she experienced the suicide of her mother. It's because of the, as she is explaining here, the interaction with them while they're in the hospital. This is simply not a proper instruction on a negligent infliction claim. It's got to allege a tort like in Champion or Zell.
Mr. Elliott.
Your Honor, this is sort of an alternative to the intentional infliction. I mean, they treated Beata Kowalski, our plaintiff's view, and evidence of support, they treated her such that it drove her to commit suicide. Now, did they do it intentionally? Did they do it negligently? Those are a couple of alternatives. But once you assume that, or once you accept the evidence on that, I think we're there. I mean, that's the way in which they treat, and that would be, you know, you come up with a lot of analogous examples, I guess, but you just use the facts in this case. I mean, she ultimately does experience the most severe injury, and Maya was witness to hearing some of that go on firsthand and then hearing about it secondhand. Both of which, in our view, are sufficient. I know that's an issue that's coming up a little bit later in the instruction.
The medical records themselves satisfy it.
Your Honor has been through the whole process that there is not a negligent cause of suicide in this case. That's why they jumped to intentional infliction. They have never alleged in the negligent infliction, even after all of these changes, that the things that caused her to have stress were experiencing the suicide, which occurred 40 miles from where she was at the time, and instead have alleged that she was experiencing the things that went on with her parents inside the hospital. That's all that's alleged there. So this simply has, I mean, interaction is what they pled and what they're trying to prove from what I've been listening to for weeks about this, but that is not a negligent infliction element that can be submitted to a jury.
I'm going to reserve on this instruction, so let's just leave it in for now.
And if it's left in, I had asked for, on page 21, an instruction that you may not rely on evidence that she heard about an incident from another person when she did not actually see or hear the incident herself. In the memo I filed over the weekend, I point out the Jane Doe versus Sinrod case from the 4th District that is quoting the Florida Supreme Court, and that the plaintiff must be involved in the incident by seeing, hearing, arriving at the scene as the traumatizing events occur. And the plaintiff must suffer, goes on from there. But the bottom line is that her hearing about things indirectly that through someone else, is that chain interrupts this and doesn't allow it to be part of the evidence for this tort.
Yeah, I'm going to reserve. I'm not in a position to rule on this one right this second.
Judge, just
Mr. Elliott,
since I know you're going to be thinking about it, this is very similar to the DV that you denied, in the sense that two things: Maya did hear some of these phone calls or phone call, did hear how her mother was being treated, and second, we've cited case law, including the Marin versus Morris case, where, you know, the person's not at the scene at all. They hear about this kidnapping, and they're able to state a claim based on that. So,
and that's that Southern District case?
Yes, Your Honor. And the Willis Supreme Court case refers to hearing the event. You know, if you're working on the copy we are, there's a note off to the right here which has Mr. Altenburns and my notes on it, and includes the cite to that Marin case.
Where would I find that?
All the way over to the right.
I mean, I've got Marin someplace, so I'm not.
Do you have a little like speaker balloon? It's not a balloon, it's a square, I guess, off to the right where is what you're looking at. Do you have red that says you may not rely on evidence? And then we down below in blue, it says plaintiffs do not agree that hearing is not sufficient per prior cited cases. And off to the right are, is the box, like the little speaker box with comments in it.
Yeah, I guess it was closed on the document I was looking at, but yeah, I see it when I open it up.
Okay.
But in cases, they're very distinguishable from what we have here. And I provided a memo on Sunday about this.
Well, both of those citations look very familiar. So
they were in the DV argument.
What's the next issue, knowing that I've reserved on?
The next is count 14, the infamous count 14, and the current instruction on this, and I believe it is in here, it was changing on me frequently, is
what page?
It begins on page
23.
Oh, see.
And it says that this is a claim of negligent training of doctors and healthcare providers, and then the hospital was negligent in training its doctors and healthcare providers. It then uses a standard instruction on negligence as if this were an automobile accident case, not a case involving medicine. It then relies on Watts versus City of Hollywood for a training means that an employer is aware or should be aware of the inadequacies of the employer's training program and was negligent in implementing its training program. Watts was a case where the employee was outside the course and scope, and they discussed the cases on that we've discussed repeatedly before, when you were going to say that this and count 11 were for people outside the scope. They dismissed the negligent supervision, retention, and the like of Ms. Beattie in exchange for my assurance that everyone was inside the scope. And now it seems like they're crying Ms. Beattie's reprimands and the like, apparently for this, I don't know. But this goes on to say that the issue you must decide is whether John Hopkins was negligent in training its doctors or healthcare providers And if so, whether that negligence was a legal cause of loss, injury, or damage. In other words, they're not requiring that one of the doctors or nurses have done anything negligent. It's only that if we have negligent training, then we are liable for loss, injury, or damage to Maya Kowalski. Now, if the element is and the doctor has to be liable, then it's a total overlap of the medical negligence claim. So I continue to believe that this is an improper instruction. And you know, we've been trying to find something within the smorgasbord of count 14 for months. We started a trial without it. I moved for directed verdict, not being able to argue this because I still didn't know what it was. And I still don't think what they gave me on Friday is a claim that should be presented to this jury.
Mr. Elliott.
Your Honor, part of the ad for healthcare, that's healthcare providers, that's my fault. I didn't fully understand this, but looking back at count 14, it does indeed plead healthcare providers as well. And I would agree, if we're talking about medical negligence, we need to make that clearer that that's the standard. But this is not just medical negligence. This is the kind of thing that resulted in the false imprisonment and in the battery, you know, properly trained. And those aren't medical claims. So it is both of those. And I would agree this instruction can be made simpler and it can be made clearer to distinguish between those.
Okay, I'll reserve and let you all try to work on it further. But I guess from a practical standpoint, do the plaintiffs even need this count? And I mean, that's up to the plaintiffs, but, you know, we seem to be spending a lot of time on something that would perhaps be duplicative of other things that are in this lawsuit. But
we are considering, Judge, what to do there.
Just like we were pinching the defense on the Fabre, can I pinch you on this issue? Because I think it would help the cause out if ultimately this cause of action is no longer a cause of action.
Okay.
But technically, I will reserve on it. See what happens.
I believe the fraud count, the language in the fraud count is fine, and that moves us on to the intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Can you point me to a page?
27?
Yes, it begins on 27. But this, too, is one where, I mean, I've given you lots of alternate instructions at this point in time, both in the renewed motion for directed verdict and in the materials I've filed now. The problem with these instructions is sort of the nature of the claim. And the one for survival damages has the front end of these problems, and then the suicide one has the rest of it. And because
let me make sure I understand. With respect to the survival claim, there's a aggravation argument that the plaintiff is making. Am I correct?
No, we're not arguing aggravation for either one of these two suicide related claims.
Okay, so that's out.
That's out.
Yeah.
But what concerns me, Your Honor, is that the extreme and outrageous conduct has to be either intentional or acts done with reckless disregard, and it has to have caused the severe emotional distress. And in this case, because it's a durational claim, and not like there's this one incident that caused Ada Kowalski some extraordinary stress. I think Mr. Anderson actually opening may have called it death by a thousand cuts, if I recall.
He called it death by the Munchausen allegation.
This all issue of fact?
Well, it is an issue of fact, but what we need are jury instructions that explain, because we have heard over and over again things that are negligent, that are rude, that are impolite. There are various things, and so I provided in the instructions that I gave you with the motion for rehearing on DV instructions that explain that fact. It has to be something. The acts still have to be something that is an intentional act and not a negligent act, because this jury has heard piles and piles and piles that are things that are negligent. But I'm still a little unclear for example, in that first week, exactly, other than maybe threaten to arrest them, anything I heard that might be fitting into the bounds of outrageous conduct. And so they need, because it's a durational one, they need the instructions that explain this. And so even if they don't get all of them, and this is in the document that's at 3541, you know, it talks about the conduct that is, I can read all of this to you.
Well, I guess what I need to drill down on is what's the specific language and where do I need to make a ruling? And let's work at it from that way.
Right.
So in theory, until I see the actual language, it's difficult for me to make a definitive ruling.
And it's in this motion, and I know we're running on time. I can slide these in where I want them so you can read them.
Why? Yeah, we're not going to agree on any language there. This concept of durational impact is just fabricated, and it's not for the lawyers here to determine what's extremely outrageous in the jury's mind. There's plenty of acts that Mr. Altenburn wants to classify as rudeness to minimize their impact that a jury will most likely find extremely outrageous. So a listing of specific acts is not required by the law, having read the memo, nor is it a determination for Mr. Altenburn or his colleagues.
As a matter of point out, all these definitions already, extreme and outrageous, emotional distress, they are all in the standard definition, which is already in the instructions.
Right. But in this case, we've had much that has been introduced that was not evidence of an act that was an intentional act to cause distress. This woman wasn't even in the hospital to experience these things. And that's why I'm requesting that, you know, during this case you've heard evidence about conduct in the hospital where employees may have acted negligently, rudely, or without a level of politeness that you might expect from a hospital employee. You've heard evidence of acts at the hospital that were required to be performed due to orders entered by the dependency court.
Let's do this.
Yep.
Add in the language you want, and then Mr. Elegant can highlight that which he disagrees with.
Okay.
It's so much easier for me to make a ruling on specific language as opposed to the concept.
And
here's a hint. No.
On causation, what I'm going to be putting in is the substantial factor has to be the substantial factor. And the reason for that is that because of the Chapter 39 limitations, you know, the concurring cause are all of these things that relate to the stresses put on Vieta because of the hearings that she was attending, because of the hearing that she would otherwise attend in February, where if she lost, she probably lost custody of her child for a while and maybe her license to practice as a nurse. There was a lot of stress placed on her by these things. And if they're described as merely concurring cause and we can't adequately explain them to the jury, it puts us in a very prejudiced position. So I, for this case, because of DCF and its immunities, I think the instruction should say the substantial factor rather than a substantial factor on causation.
And Your Honor, of course we object to that because the rule, the standard instruction says, you have it's a substantial cause. It doesn't say the primary cause. You're not required to be the primary or the substantial. The rule says a, and then the rule goes on, the comments go on to say substantial has an acceptable common meaning.
Ready to say, I think Mr. Altenburn is deviating from what the law says. So I understand you're going to propose it.
I'm going to propose it because of the difference, because in this case, I can't put on evidence. I mean, you're not going to let me put on evidence of what I just described to you about the stresses that Vieta was going through.
Are you sure?
Are you?
I mean, we can.
That's why I want to see the specific. If you're asking for a definition of something, you know, put it down. If you want the language, put it down where you want it, and then I'll let Mr. Elegant come and object to the specific language. I think that's probably what we need to do at this point. where we're at.
Let's pick a new, if I could suggest, we pick a new color to code all this new stuff that we're going to be looking at.
I do intend to argue all those other causes. Okay.
And then on the suicide one, I mean, the instruction on page 31, to me, is just, you know, it's not even in the standard structure that we use for this instruction. Once we get by the fact that you know, if you decide on the seventh claim, you can't go here because there isn't enough of the extreme and outrageous conduct to go on to suicide. That makes sense. But then they jump immediately to the hospital is liable for the death of Bieda Kowalski if it caused Bieda Kowalski to act on an irresistible impulse or if John Hopkins was a substantial factor in the death of Bieda Kowalski. It doesn't use any of the other standard language. And then it adds this thing about what I mean, because I had suggested an instruction on it ought to be that we specifically intended it for her to commit suicide. Now they're being told it doesn't have to be that, even though we can't argue that. So we're left here with two causation things instead of one, neither of which are defined. And so this is the first time this theory has ever been submitted to a jury, to the best of our knowledge, is anywhere in America. And it's being done under a weird set of facts because it is this thing over a long period of time rather than one event. This is not like a woman who saw her children burned and tortured by someone, and in distraught, she grabbed the gun that he was using and shot herself. That's not what we have. We have a completely different story here. Someone who's not even in the hospital to witness any of these things. So we need thorough instructions on what an irresistible impulse is, and if you actually choose to use substantial factor, which is just like concurring cause language, then it needs something very special. And I have laid out several different options on this, and the one I filed yesterday, because it appeared to me that you weren't going to give the instructions that I used in the motion for rehearing, I've added alternate definitions of these and basically given you selections that you can use it for these things. And I can read them all to you, but the truth is that there needs to be an instruction on these things. You know, if we're going to use irresistible impulses, right now we've only heard from a psychiatrist who made up some psychiatric stuff about someone who...
Can I interrupt for just a second?
No.
Because I need to leave, and I just wanted to say, Judge, I've got witness interviews. As much as I love listening to Mr. Alton Brandt re-argue his DVs and summary judgments, and oh.
You can leave.
Okay.
Thank you.
But the definition of this is an irresistible impulse is a sudden spontaneous inclination or incitement to commit an act such as suicide as an unpremeditated action. That's the standard human English language definition of it. If you go to the law where this is normally used for criminal acts, it's an overpowering impulse produced by mental disease or defect that leads to the commission of the act of suicide. And I have previously suggested, and I think it's far better than no instruction on definition of all, that it's no ability to know what she was doing at the time of the suicide such that she could not stop herself from committing suicide. I thought that was a reasonable set of words to use given the case law that was out there from other states on motions to dismiss and the like. So
what would be the most helpful is, Mr. Altman, you put in the language you want, and then Mr. Elegant can dump in the language he wants. One can be in orange, the other can be in blue. It doesn't have to be orange and blue. Just not garnet and gold.
And I'll give these various options on this.
I would like for you to choose the one you want.
Well, my problem is that this is a case of first impression. And I can live with any one of these. And if you can live with one of these, I want you to...
Okay. Option A, option B, option C, and option D.
Okay.
But let's all put it
all right
where it's going to flow.
Then...
And, Your Honor, I would just note the language we have there on 31 in yellow, I took directly from the transcript. And I think an alternative definition is, or alternative causation is fine. We have that, for example, in products liability, in strict liability or negligence. I mean, it's the same injury from the same product. You can have both ways to get there.
When there's two separate causes of action, not for one cause of action. I know of no example of this. I really think you have to settle on one. I know it's difficult, but we can't be, I mean, this is just not the way to try this case. The last thing on these, it goes to the per hour per element motion that I filed asking for a better instruction on the extent to which, if they use those arguments, A, if you're going to allow the argument, which I believe you should not, that we're entitled to have some knowledge of this ahead of time and have the instruction that I put into that memo, which basically says
you want to be able to do the math ahead of time.
Yeah, in the $15 million case, it took me about 35 minutes to convince myself that I was absolutely right, that the number was about 20% higher than the math that was supported it. And because these things are very, very complicated, and they also, as that case and a couple other cases that I haven't put in here demonstrate, that they cause verdicts that create real problems with whether they're beyond the range in which a jury is free to operate. They end up doing high numbers because the jury thinks that it is in fact reasonable to do a per hour, 18 hours a day for each component of the damages. And it's very difficult to respond to those things when juries think that this is something that is recognized by the law to do that. So I've asked, if you're going to do this, to at least have an instruction that, instead of saying that there's no exact standard for measuring such damage, says there's no judicially approved method or standard for measuring such damage. Methods suggested by the parties in closing arguments are not methods established by law. They are only arguments presented on behalf of a party. It is the province of the jury, using its own common sense and experience, to determine a fair and just amount in light of the evidence. I think that would at least go a ways to solving this problem, but I still want to see the math so I can figure out ahead of time if there are other objections to be made to it.
Your Honor, I'm sure Mr. Anderson would love to see a draft of their closing argument ahead of time, a script that they, if they agreed, they would stick to it. That's what this is all about, I think, is it's getting a preview. And the math, I mean, they're, whether it's 18 hours or 24 hours in a day, there's 365 days in a year. One number times 365 times life expectancy, that's not hard arithmetic. I mean, everybody's got a calculator. I could do that in a minute.
Well,
we got two Harvard.
Let's talk about the suggested language that deviates from the standard that was in Mr. Altenburn's memo. Thoughts on that, Mr. Elliott?
Oh, I think saying there's no exact science, it's in your discretion, is what the jury is typically told. I don't know why we need to do anything different here. I mean, this is...
What's your position? Because Mr. Altenburn is seeking something other than the standard. And he laid it out in his memo on the 26th.
Right, Your Honor. And that actually cites to a brief that I believe Mr. Altenburn wrote in a case that never got decided. Painting out this, you know, in that case, the parade of horribles, they settled it. So, you know, I don't think that's really authority for anything. There's no case that holds you can't do this.
No, in
fact, there's lots of cases that say per diem is fine.
I'm well aware of that. I'm talking about the specific language that Mr. Altenburn wants differing from the standard, which is there is no judicially approved method or standard for measuring such damage. Methods suggested by the parties in closing arguments are not methods established by law. They are only arguments presented on behalf of a party. It is the province of the jury using its own common sense and experience to determine a fair and just amount in the light of the evidence.
That last sentence is fine. No, I mean, of course, you're already going to tell them that arguments are just arguments. So yeah. This is repetitive.
I will tell you, Mr. Altenburden, you can keep it in. I likely would go with the standard on that.
All right. I would just want to preserve it. I do know that there is a new trial order on this issue that is just going on appeal in the Sixth Judicial Circuit, in the Sixth DCA, but that's all I know about it. So we'll see.
The Sixth Judicial Circuit? The
Sixth DCA from the Ninth Circuit is where it came from.
So you've been busy.
Well, over the weekend, one of my appellate partners told me that they had just heard of this order, so that's all I know about. On the dependency order that you're going to reread, and this is something that, because I listened this morning, I wanted to add, so I was going to just give people time as well, but there's one additional explanation about immunity that I think is needed because of how this case is playing out. Because right now we've said that it's immune from any civil claim which might otherwise result by reason of reporting the suspected abuse. Having said that, All Children's Hospital does not have immunity for any of the claims being presented to you as a jury. What I'm suggesting here is that although Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital does not have immunity for any of the claims being presented to you, it does have immunity for any act it took in good faith to comply with the requirements of these orders. Because that's straight out of Section 39203(1)(a), that it not only do you have immunity for reporting, but you have immunity for things that you do in good faith to fulfill the things that you're obligated to do because of those orders.
Conceptually, here's my concern. That first DCA decision, and I can't remember, it was a fourth, that interpreted the Chapter 39 did not discuss the good faith.
Right.
And I disagreed with how they interpreted the statute, but I'm bound by it. But that was an issue of law.
Right.
And we really... If you're suggesting that I would put a good faith finding in the hands of a jury on an issue of law where the cases didn't, for a finding of reasonable suspicion that I had to make as a, or that they had reasonable cause to suspect child abuse as an issue of law and convert that into an issue of fact for the jury, I'm concerned about doing that.
And I am suggesting that in this case, it's a question of fact as to whether we complied in good faith as to these orders from what I heard the arguments this morning. It's not going to be a negligence test or some sort of strict liability for breaching a court order. We have immunity for the steps involved in doing this beyond reporting so long as we do those things in good faith. If they find that we did things in bad faith, we're liable for those things.
Put it in, but I am wary about creating a factual finding when those decisions that I'm bound by blew past the good faith and made issues of law for the court to find as far as reasonable suspicion. And okay. So
Your Honor, if I can,
I'm concerned about that.
Yeah, and Your Honor, I have other problems with that too. The line, it does not have immunity for any act it took in good faith to comply with the requirements of the orders. Are we going to put all these orders in front of the jury? Are we going to get to, good faith? This is just entering into a whole Chapter 39 area that we've been, I thought, trying to stay out of.
Mr. Elliott, I don't think it's ultimately going to make its way in the final jury instructions, but I'm certainly willing to read what Mr. Altenburn wants to put in.
On the verdict form, Your Honor, I submit, well, the plaintiffs gave me, or filed one yesterday, I actually put it in the court file, that really won't, it doesn't come close. For a number of reasons, but It, for example, does damages for counts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7, which actually involve both Maya and her father, and ask for an award of non-economic and economic damages for all of those torts, and they have to be done individually, as Mr. Elegant knows, because he will argue the two-issue rule against me to the hilt if I ever agree to this. I've got to have numbers for each and every one of those. I had, by the way, initially suggested doing all the liability questions first and then have all the damages questions second. And Mr. Elegant told me that that's not what the plaintiffs wanted, so I did it the other way. And now I've gotten one from them that has all the damages at the end and the liability questions first. I'm flexible on that. I just need to know what the final position is of the place on how to lay out a verdict form on that. The last thing that I think is a kind of a disagreement between this, they're using very straight questions like, you know, for example, on fraud, did John Hopkins All Children's Hospital commit fraud? And I'm laying out a little more of the issue. In particular, in this case, where the jury instructions are going to be a small book, if this isn't like a negligence case with one issue where you can ask whether the driver of the car was negligent and whether it caused damages to the plaintiff, this is something where each one of these things they're going to have to study. And I believe that a basic description of what the issue is that they're determining ought to be in the question that they're asking, just to help us get accuracy.
And, Your Honor, that's why we submitted the verdict form we did, because the jury instructions are already a small book. The verdict form submitted by the defense was yet another small book, 18 or 20 pages. So our view is there's no need to rehash all of the jury instructions in the verdict form, and especially in the way it was done, which are, of course, the defense-favored jury instructions, placing those in the verdict form. So ours are simple because they'll have the jury instructions, and then they have a question.
They didn't want a long verdict form. They could have filed a shorter complaint.
Are you asking me to make a ruling? I'm unclear as to what I'm supposed to do at this second.
I mean, I suggest that maybe Mr. Elegant works on one that might come close to complying with two-issue rule and the like from his side, and I can finish out what I'm doing on mine. My people have actually been concerned about whether I have to do itemized damages for non-economic one by one to preserve issues for appeal because of the duplication problem.
Well, that was going to be my very next question.
Yeah.
Because, and I'm assuming I'm looking at yours.
Yes.
It doesn't lay that out. And what if, let's say they make a finding as far as false imprisonment for that first week, but not on the others?
No, we're going to have them find on each one of those things, because not only does it affect damages, but it affects punitive damages on that one. And there's a lot of findings on Dr. Smith. All of those things have to be there, or I'm committing malpractice myself.
Assume for the sake of argument that the jury finds false imprisonment on the first week and the EEG room, but not on the photo session. So just assume that.
Right.
The way this verdict form reads is it does not distinguish the damages
for each one. I think my client is willing to take the risk of clumping those together for compensatory, but as far as the punitive is concerned, these things have to be broken down. So, I think we could look at the damages on compensatory and get a sense of whether it, since we know how many it is, whether this would be in a reasonable range they could come to collectively, but the punitives are different.
I was anticipating seeing a punitives section immediately after the false imprisonment and then another punitive section right after the battery.
We had done that when there was a second defendant in the case, and I can still do that. We can have it twice. At one point in time, both sides were working on doing a single one at the end of the first two, and
if we do a single one, then how would we know what the jury finds is the punitive conduct?
Well, right now, it's under the circumstances of this case, state whether you find by clear and convincing evidence that punitive damages are warranted for. That's standard language. A, the claim of false imprisonment, A1 is between October 7th and 13th. A2 is between October 18th and the 20th. And A3 is the January the 4th. And then it jumps to a B section, which is the one and only battery that's there, so that they can say yes and no, and that way we'll know those things.
Okay, so conceptually what you're saying is we'll do them all together, and then we will just trust the jury to only if you answer a certain question as yes, would you do it?
Right, yeah. And we can confirm that they're being consistent, but the only thing that changes if we do it twice is we take out this B, and we move it behind batteries rather than, I mean, we have one in front of false imprisonment and one in front of battery. I think the extra page and a half in the verdict form is worse than trying to do it this way. That's all I was trying to do.
Okay.
Because Boy Scouts on, I was not trying to make this thing any longer than it is.
One other thing we've talked about, but we need to work on, I think, Your Honor, is some language or methodology so that the jurors aren't duplicating damages, but yet, for example, if the jurors were to find that there were similar, you know, that there were some overlapping damage for, say, the false imprisonment on January 6th and the battery on January 6th, I think we need to those may be the same damages. And if for some reason down the road, one of those claims was to be knocked out for some reason, we wouldn't want all the damages knocked out if part of it was overlapping. So we have to, I think we talked about a non-duplication language, but I think we're gonna have to work on that a little more to make that work.
The language I used, Your Honor, was any damages awarded for this claim shall not duplicate damages that you awarded in answering question. And for number two, it's one. And then, I mean, progressively you have to add counts to this.
Right. And that, I think that's okay as far as it goes. But the problem is, let's say they're not awarding some damages for count three or four, and count one gets knocked out. And now the damages that would have been in three or four went with that. We have to figure out how to deal with that. Okay. So I think it can be done. We just have to think about it.
Because I think at this point, I'm not making rulings at this point, and we're just talking, and I want to come up with a game plan that we all can live with. Mr. Altenburn's going to get back and is going to add in whatever language he wants, make the changes to the rulings that I made today, and then Mr. Elegant can then annotate off of what Mr. Altenburn has done. Obviously, we can't do anything tomorrow afternoon. We have some ability on Wednesday. I am quickly coming to the conclusion that I probably will not be able to go to that meeting on at least Thursday morning, and that we'll probably have to try to finish
these things then
on Thursday morning. Wednesday afternoon into Thursday morning. It's difficult because I have an event at 7:30 on Wednesday evening that if I can make it, I'd like to. So it sounds like maybe we go a little bit longer on Wednesday, and then whatever we haven't finished, we pick back up early on Wednesday morning, and when I say early, we might come in at 8:15 to start on jury instructions on, sorry, on Thursday. I meant on Thursday. So that I can get up to where I need to go for as much of those meetings on Thursday as possible.
Your Honor, what time could you, as I've got some conflicts on Thursday, what time do those meetings start for you?
9 o'clock, but they go
on. Oh, if we're going to be, done by nine, then that's not a problem.
Oh, I'm not going to be finished by nine. I mean, it's, I was hopeful to be finished probably by 10:30, 11. On Thursday?
Yeah, okay, I'm confused. Are we going to, did you want to start early on Thursday or start after 10:30?
No. Let me back up. I think we would start Wednesday evening after we finish the evidence.
I'm good on that.
And then work until I need to go to the event. And then we pick up Thursday morning early, starting at about 8:15. But it would probably go until mid-morning.
That would be fine. I just have a, I almost hate to say this, but I'm on another seminar speaking engagement Thursday late, but it's later in the morning. So stopping by 10:30 or whatever would be fine.
I'm on the Florida Court Technology Commission, and you know, I've got obligations there, but at the end of the day, I need to get jury instructions done too, so we can try to land this plane early next week.
Well, I will get these revisions and things done as soon as I can and get them to Mr. Elliott, hopefully by 10 in the morning or so at the latest.
And do we think we could have by like Wednesday morning, like by about 8:30, 9 o'clock, whatever Mr. Elliott's objections are to Mr. Altenburn's language?
Your Honor, if I get him Tuesday morning, you'll have him Tuesday night.
Okay, so that's our plan. Wednesday evening after evidence, we will pick jury instructions back up, and then to the extent we don't finish, we will start again early on Thursday morning.
And Your Honor,
my goal would be to have either a final version or a next to final version by the time we walk out on Thursday.
What time would you think Wednesday we would be convening?
I probably am going to say we're going to probably start about 8:15 on Thursday morning.
Thursday, but I meant for Wednesday. You talked about starting the instructions Wednesday night.
Wednesday after we finish the evidence.
So that would be 5-ish.
Well, if Mr. Anderson and Mr. Whitney are targeted on their cross examinations,
you beat me to it, Judge.
So in some respects, it's controllable by your trial counsel.
Yes, and Your Honor, if you think it would be useful, what Mr. Altman and I have been doing, and you can see it in the copy you're looking at, is we're putting some comments out to the side. So if he's going to put a comment, I want this because of this, I will try to respond to that. You may get kind of a preview, if that's useful.
That's fine, but I want physical language. If you are objecting and want to propose your own, I want to see it right there.
Oh, yes.
Whether it's in a comment on the side or in the body of the text, that's, I don't care. But so long as it's right there and I'm not having to go to 14 different things and trying to conceptualize where it's going to go.
I'm fine putting it in a comment on the right in that different color in there. And I suspect most of mine will not be seeking to add, but we'll be seeking to detract or deduct from it. We may have some specials ourselves. We're still looking at that, but they won't be major.
Well, if you're going to have any specials, it needs to get into this draft that's going to be in my hands, you said, Tuesday night.
Tomorrow night, yes.
Anything else?
Nick heard that, so we're good to go.
All right. Anything
else for the good of the order? Everyone ready to
not here.
Go to your respective corners and keep working?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Have a good day. We'll be in recess until 8:30 tomorrow.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
More
full live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
Despiértate, que el $4 breakfast meal deal ha llegado a McDonald's. Incluye un sausage McMuffin o sausage biscuit, hash brown y un café caliente. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu meal deal. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big. Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Ten hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needing something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.